right, everybody. Welcome in to Loretta McNary Live, and it is Monday. So that means it is Ask an Attorney Monday right here on Loretta McNary Live. Thank you guys so much for tuning in, guys and beautiful ladies. We have a wonderful show for you today, and as you know, Monday has been a thing about law and legal, and so I've met some of the most amazing attorneys here, not only in the Memphis area, but truly around the country, and so that's what we'll be doing now is talking to someone who is actually has her practice in Mississippi. Yes, she is the first non-located here in Memphian attorney, and let me tell you, when I say the bar is still raised very, very high, pardon the pun. I'm so excited that we have Victoria Washington with us today. And let me just tell you a little about her so you'll know where we're coming from. Because you know, if she's on the show, that means she is the creme de la creme, the top of the list, the best of the best. She, armed with her bachelor's degree, she began her master's program at Belhaven University while teaching sixth and seventh graders language arts and... She worked at the Chasten Middle School. Yeah, she has a ton of stuff I'm trying to tell you about. So Ms. Washington served as the head coach of the girls' basketball team. In addition to teaching language arts, right, she's the head coach of the girls' basketball team and assistant coach of the volleyball team. But after her second year of teaching in the Jackson Public School District and interning with the Committee on Homeland Security in Washington, D.C., Victoria decided it was time to pursue her dreams. She was accepted to the University of Mississippi School of Law in Oxford, Mississippi in 2011. While there, she served as chairman in the Black Law Student Association. She was a member of the Dean's Leadership Council and held as the winner and semifinalist in several moot court and trial
I think I lost you.
Okay, I'll tell you, technology. Victoria, thank you so much for staying on the call with us. So, everybody, welcome to Loretta McNary Live, Ask an Attorney Monday, Victoria Washington. Hi there. Let me get you back on here.
How are you doing?
I'm great. You know what? When I got your bio, I was super impressed. And I'm not easily impressed because I've had, like I said, some of the best attorneys. But you came highly recommended from a friend of the show, Quentin, I'm telling you, with Morgan and Morgan. So anyway, Victoria, did you always want to be an attorney? Because I know you said follow your dream. So was that something you always wanted to become?
A lot of people don't believe it, but actually, yes. I represented the wolf against the three little pigs in the third grade, and I was destined to be an attorney ever since. I got him off. He really did not. Yes, he did not blow those houses down, I'm telling you.
I love
just have to
that.
Look at it from both sides of the lens. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, since the third grade.
So you were able to get him
attorney.
Off? So you
I got him
roof?
Off. Yeah, I don't know if my teacher had, you know, sympathy or pity, but I got him off.
We don't care when it comes to a case. A win is a win. So
a win
is
a win.
Super impressive. It is. A win is a win. So it's as early as the third grade, but you decided to go into teaching first.
I did. I went into teaching because I played ball at Tougaloo College. I thought I wanted to do, I was going to segue into coaching. Playing ball was my first love. And I kind of segued away from being an attorney until I started teaching and said, oh, something's missing. So I just went back to it. Mm-hmm.
I knew back to it. I love it. I love it. And so after law school, you began working at Sparkman, Zumach, and Perry, and then served as a law clerk in the Sixth Circuit Court Judicial District and you worked at Terry Griffin PC in South Haven, Mississippi. And in January 2018, last year, you started your own firm, the Washington Law Firm. I love that.
I did.
So how has that been? Because you just celebrated a year. Congratulations.
I know. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate it. It was a year, January 8th, and so I actually haven't really told many people. I've been blessed to have my doors open and people come in. Just blessed. Just blessed to have consistent flow of clients, just telling other people about my service. And so I haven't gone live yet, but I guess this probably would be live.
Yeah, now you have, not only locally, but to the world.
I know, right?
Okay,
so I guess everybody knows.
Yeah, they will know. We will help a lot of people to know that you're celebrating 1 year. Okay, do you remember the very first case you worked on and then the very first one you took to trial?
The very first case I worked on.
I know, it's been a while now.
I know, because it's really hard. I do remember the very first criminal case that I worked on, so I can't tell you the very first personal injury or anything like that, but I can tell you the first criminal case was I was actually working with an attorney, and he was trying, I think it was a murder case, but they had an expert who wanted to bring shoe print analysis, and I just finished interning with the Innocence Project under Professor Tucker Carrington, and we'd done an extensive course on the unreliability of shoe print analysis and expertise. And so I remember specifically doing a lot of research on how to get that the expert's opinion thrown out. And I remember that was a case that I was really excited about, actually, that I could put what I had just learned in law school to work. And the first trial was an assault on a police officer and possession of marijuana that I was able to get my client off on. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you mentioned personal injury, and I know now you kind of specialize in criminal law. So what other areas of law have you worked cases on?
I do personal injury as well. My baby is criminal law, and I have just a personal affinity to criminal law. I do personal injury, family law. That's pretty much it. Well, civil rights, and I do a lot of post-conviction relief, actually. A lot of people contact me while they're incarcerated, and I've actually been able to successfully get recently one of my clients out. She had a 20-year sentence, and now she's at home. She's on house arrest, but she's at home. So I get
she's
a lot of post-conviction relief as well. She's at home.
Okay, so we haven't talked a lot about I'm sorry. Okay. So what did you just say? I was interrupting you because I'm trying to really find out more about the post-conviction. But what were you saying after you said she's at home now on house arrest?
No, it was nothing but God. She's at home. I was just repeating that she's at home. I have to tell myself that she's at home. that was all.
Okay. So, and that is incredible. Oh, wow. If I didn't have to keep this show moving, I would stay there a long time and really have a praise break, because I'm a Jesus girl too, and I give him glory for everything. And that is huge for you and for her. So what is post-conviction, what you call it, relief?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's abbreviated. You will hear it a lot, PCR. And so post-conviction relief is pretty much a person. So I'll walk you quickly through the criminal process. Usually a person is indicted. They're charged first, and then they're indicted. Either the grand jury will return a true bill, which says they're indicted, or a no bill, which means that they don't believe there's enough probable cause or enough evidence to indict them on the charge. And, of course, we've had so many criminal proceedings from Freddie Gray to, you know, all of the people who've been killed and looking for prosecutorial indictments, but it's it's not hard to get an indictment. So once a person is indicted, they go before the court, and they either have a trial or they plead guilty. Whatever, however they end up incarcerated, a post-conviction release says, I'm incarcerated, and there are a very limited reasons that I should be granted relief. I need to go back before the court because either one, the law was not substantiated, it's unconstitutional, or that I did not have effective assistance of counsel. And you do know that everyone who's charged with the crime, they are entitled to effective counsel. And then the third thing is either there is newly discovered evidence that shows that at the time of the plea or at the time of the trial, it was not available. Now, after the trial, it is available. So those are the top three exceptions to incarceration where you can get back before the judge and say, hey, I need a second chance. I need you to relook at this because I don't supposed to be here. And so that's what post-conviction relief is. And it's hard because once you take a plea, once you go to trial, it's hard. When I tell you, extremely difficult to get you back out. So that's what post-conviction relief is to get back before the court to say, I need you to take a second look at my case.
Wow, that is impressive. Again, very impressive. Because I have not covered that. We've covered a ton of areas of law, but we have not covered that. So maybe you'll come back. You'll graciously accept my invitation to come back and we can talk about that because I'm sure our audience, because generally everybody probably knows somebody who's incarcerated or been incarcerated themselves or looking or fighting to keep from being incarcerated. So that's why I love the value of doing this Ask an Attorney program. So that's hope, though. That's like it's not over because I'm thinking once you are indicted and you're told how long your sentence and you're in jail, then you serve out your time unless somebody gives you what is that, what the president or governor or somebody can give you clemency or something, get you out.
Clemency or some type of pardon. Mm-hmm. Well, it's okay, still difficult, so don't I don't want to be misleading. It's difficult.
Right, you said
and when
it.
I tell
you said
it's really
hard,
difficult.
It's difficult.
And I tell my, you know, those cases that I do decide to take, those are the ones that I can pursue with full faith that they have a chance. You know, there are many mm-hmm. people who call me, and it's just I don't see it. But if I get one that I see on my desk and say, okay, this is a chance, it's worth the amount of money and time to put into pursuing this, then I take them. But it's hard. It's difficult. And I always tell, you know, people, if I can talk to do any type of seminar, if I can do a Know Your Rights, I tell all of members of the public, take criminal charges seriously. Take guilty pleas seriously. Take them. Because a lot of people think I can take this plea and I can fix it later. No. Make sure it's informed and it's intelligently made before you make it. Otherwise, it's hard. Once they have your body, it's hard to get it back, you know, into the free world. It really is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. So when people are taking a plea or going ahead and plead guilty, is that keeping them from going to trial? Or what would make somebody say, you know, I did it, as opposed to trying to go to trial and see if they can get off, which is what you hire an attorney for, regardless if you did it or not. So are they coerced into taking a plea, or are they saying, I don't want to go to trial, maybe I want to protect my family, or, you know?
That's a loaded question.
You know,
because say that again.
You know, we see a lot of stuff on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So we get all our information from that.
And I think that's, you know, that can be a misconception, and a lot of people go into it, believe it or not. I just reviewed some literature on what a lot of people who are incarcerated, a lot of issues that they have. The number one issue is that they didn't have communication with their counsel to understand the plea agreement. And they're going to go through. When you go to court, the judge is going to go through, are you happy with your counsel? Have they explained everything to you? And most often, hopefully, you know, I try to look on the side of optimism to say that those who defend members of the criminal community are you know, they take their oath seriously and they are explaining everything to them. But the number one, whether, you know, you take it as true or false, you know, most people say everybody in jail is innocent. But whether you take it as true or not, the first thing they say is they were misled. That's the first thing, whether it's true or not. They say they were misled. And so I don't necessarily think it's coercion. You know, you have the right to stand before the judge to say, you know, I didn't do this. But a lot of times they're afraid. I think the number one issue, the number one reason that many people take pleas is fear. It's fear. They're afraid to go to trial, even if, you know, and I'm a little, I did the Innocence Project. And so those people who I represented, they, you know, it's their contention that they're innocent. And so a lot of people say that, well, I didn't think that if I went to trial in this state or in this community, I would have gotten a fair chance. You'll hear that more often than not. The jury doesn't look like me. What I'm accused of, I wouldn't stand a chance. So it's better for me to take this plea agreement. I'm looking at 15 years. The prosecutors offer me 3 years. I know I didn't do it, but if I go to trial and I lose, I'll get 15. I'll just take these 3. That's what okay, happens a lot of times.
That's the thought process. Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's you know,
because I know
and
there
got
to be some people who were.
Those who know they've done it. I think it's a more let me make the best decision. You know, let me try to relieve the amount of time I stay behind bars. So you do have guilty clients, of course. Not everyone is innocent.
Yeah, and. You're innocent until proven guilty, but now it seems like some of the cases that make national media, the people are guilty until proven innocent, the reverse of how it was set up originally, which is, to me, crazy and unfortunate. So what I want to do now, I want to pause just a moment to thank my sponsors for today's show, and ATOP, which is also called A Tour of Possibilities. It is created to share the historical and cultural gems that African Americans have contributed to Memphis, Tennessee. And so if you want to take a grand tour or an overview tour with food, please call Carolyn Michael Banks at 901-326-3736. Okay, I've taken that tour personally. I adore Carolyn, and that tour you are going to laugh, you're going to cry, it is going to cause you to think, and you might get a little upset because she tells you everything that happened, and I think she touches about 5 to throughout the downtown area, Stax, the Civil Rights Museum, of course, the hotel, the location where King was shot, and the church as well where he gave his last speech. So make sure that you take advantage of what we have here in Memphis, and it's called A Tour of Possibilities, 901-326-3736. Now back to your regularly scheduled interview. Okay, so you have already talked about so many things that I haven't talked about, and I got a ton of questions. So you walk us through what happens if you have committed a crime or you are accused of having committed a crime. What is the first thing you should do other than call, most people are going to call their mom, I'm sure. But after that, what should we do, Victoria?
Don't say anything. Don't say anything and invoke your right to counsel.
Okay.
Don't say anything. Invoke your right to counsel, hire an attorney, or request one. That's the most important thing I can tell any person who's been charged with a crime.
Is to don't say anything. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's powerful when you think about it, though, because we do, again, on TV, get our information from all these shows on TV, and we see where they, what's that called? They read you your Miranda rights?
Mm-hmm. And then that's
some kind of right.
A lot of people don't understand. They don't understand when you know, they're supposed to be read their Miranda rights. So I get a lot of people come in and say, well, they didn't read me my rights. I was like, well, they didn't have to. Not at that juncture. They didn't have to read you your rights. The only time that officers are required to read you your Miranda rights is if they are about to interrogate you and to question you. Otherwise, they don't have to. Only for interrogation.
So when you're arrested, mm-hmm. they don't have to read the rights right then when they're putting you in handcuffs in the back of the car or whatever.
No, unless they're asking you questions. If they're going to ask you questions, then you need to know that once I respond, I'm waiving my right to counsel, and these statements can be used against me. So once they begin asking you questions, then you should be Mirandized. Otherwise, there's no reason to, you know, state that if they're not going to talk to you, then you don't need to know that whatever you say can be used against you, because there shouldn't be any reason why you're talking to them.
Oh. So what if you initiate the conversation? Will they tell you, since you're going to talk, I have to go ahead and tell you, you have the right to remain silent or whatever? If you, as the person that they are detaining... Again, I watch movies and TV. I don't know anybody personally who has, you know, done that, but I'm trying to get all these myths out of the way that I have an expert on TV. So, I mean, on the call with me.
Yeah, well, I'm not an expert, but I just want to qualify that statement that I'm definitely not an expert. But if you volunteer, anything is voluntary, and you would be dealing with an awesome officer if he said, wait, don't volunteer this statement. Let me tell you that you shouldn't tell me this. That's you are. You are,
that's probably not
going to
happen.
I've never experienced that. Yeah, that's not going to happen at all. So, yeah, if you volunteer a statement, then it will be used against you. It's voluntary. Mm-hmm.
So you have not said anything, and they've taken you to wherever they take you to detain you. At what point do they allow you to call your attorney? And what happens if you don't have an attorney already?
Well, you should get a phone call once you're arrested. But the thing is that everybody said, well, I didn't get my phone call. But it's so much that goes behind the scenes when you are detained, whether you are really detained or arrested. And those are two different legal terms, right? So if you're detained, then you feel that you're not it should be temporary. It's done for questioning or for officer safety. And at that point, they have to make a decision whether or not they want to arrest you. And so it just depends on what stage of the stop you're in. If you're stopped and you're detained, then, of course, you're not entitled to a phone call. But once you're arrested, you have to go through the booking process or whatever that department does in order to book you. So it just depends. So it's a hard question to answer without knowing what phase you're in.
Detained, then. Let's go there. You're being detained. What are your rights if they are detaining you? Are they the same as if you're being arrested?
If you are detained, your right to counsel arises once you're arrested, right? Or once they start to interrogate you. So if they start to interrogate you, then you have your right to counsel. Once you're under arrest, then you have a right to counsel. Now, if you're detained and they're doing a stop and they're patting you down, then your right to counsel has not arisen yet. And so what you want, you need to see what stage you're in. So say, for instance, you're at Walmart, and you're being detained. There are a couple of people running out of the store who have allegedly stolen some merchandise, and you are detained. He detains you and say, what's your name? Where, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he tries to make sure that you're not the person who's taking the merchandise. He'll pat you down and let you go. Well, your right to counsel did not arise at that point because you weren't under arrest and he hasn't let you go. Now, there are some questions about how long that you're detained before it equates to an arrest. And so that gets a little convoluted, so I'll pass by that. But you can be under arrest, you can be detained for a certain amount of time that will eventually evolve into an arrest if they hold you long enough and probable cause does not suggest that you should be detained. So it would arise to an arrest. So it just depends on that. But once you're arrested and you're booked in, you should be able to call counsel if they are interrogating you, or if there's a need to call your attorney. And
okay.
So it just depends. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I like to bring up a lot of different scenarios because, like I said, I don't know personally how this works, and this is just people have told me something or I've watched a crime show. So I'm trying to – and then I have my other phone where people are texting me some questions, so we'll get into those too. For those who just tuned in, you are listening to Loretta McNary Live, and it is Monday, so it is Ask an Attorney Monday. And my attorney today is Victoria A. Washington with the Washington Law Firm, PLLC, and she's located in South Haven, Mississippi. So, and I'm almost interrogating her, and I really hate that, but I just have so many questions about criminal law and criminal justice and personal injury. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're talking about today. And if you are listening online and you have a question, or you're listening on your phone, in order to go into the queue so that I can go to you and allow you in, you have to press the number 1, and then I'll know that you have a question and you're not just listening. So all the callers that we have on the board, if you have a question or a comment, please press the number 1 on your phone, and that will get you into the queue, and we will invite you on to ask your question. And for those that are listening online, you can also – there is an option for you to send a question if you're listening online, or you can dial in with your phone and ask a question. So we do have a caller, and I'm going to go straight to the phone line, and I'm coming to, we have a lot of callers, but nobody's pressing the number 1 until now. So we're going to 601-291. That is your prefix. Okay. Hi, caller. Welcome to Loretta McNary Live. Ask an Attorney.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question for Attorney Washington. I'm wondering what sort of have you witnessed any injustices in the criminal justice system? And if so, what types of injustices have you witnessed or encountered?
Okay, that's a good question. I have actually, and injustice is so broad, so I guess you'll leave that up to me. The first thing that I've encountered, especially in North Mississippi, that bothers me, and it bothers me in a great deal, is large time. I think it's an injustice where you have a person who pleads guilty. They get 20 years, 5 years to serve, 5 years post-release supervision, right? And so you have some of these people are first-time offenders. So they get a max sentence, but what they're looking at is only the amount of time that they have to serve. So you have 20 years, but only 5 years to serve. You have a new law that says that you only have to serve 25% of that sentence. So you do the math, 25% of 5 could be a year and a half or so. So they're looking at, well, I'll get out in a year and a half, and it's not a lot of time. But unfortunately, what they're not considering is that they have 20 over their head. So if they do anything, and usually you don't get your sentence revoked. And when I say revoked is if you only have to serve a year and a half, you still have 20 years hanging over your head. So if you commit another crime, you have to go back before that judge, and he can give you all of that time. To me, that's an injustice. And what we don't realize is that when we take these deals, when we take deals that look like that, we're looking at freedom. I get out in a year and a half, but they're not looking at the possibility of having to go back before the judge for a separate and detached crime. And so even if you get charged with something different, you have to look at that time plus all of the time that they gave you hanging over your head. To me, I think that that keeps the criminal justice system in reach of you, regardless if you've served that time or not. And so I think that prosecutors have to look at just who they're sentencing and just looking at, they have broad discretion in the type of sentences that they can hand out. And I think having that much time over your head does not really serve what, you know, sentencing is for. You know, you have to look at recidivism. You have to look at the injustice in policing in the communities. And so especially if you have an African-American person who has 20 years, well, think about what statistics say about an African-American male and his face with a police officer in 20 years of his life. He will probably encounter a police officer 5 to 10 times within those 20 years, and you hope that that police officer is fair. And so that, to me, that's a huge injustice in the criminal justice system. And another thing is just the type of sentences you get, seeing a disparity in what type of sentences you get versus charges such as shoplifting versus embezzlement. You have some people being charged with shoplifting. You have others for the same crime being charged with embezzlement, and they have two distinct roles that they play. But one is a disenfranchising crime where it allows people aren't allowed to vote if they're charged with embezzlement versus shoplifting. And so this is all prosecutorial discretion in how they charge you, but they have separate and detached consequences. One, you serve your time and you go on with a misdemeanor offense, or, you know, shoplifting can be grand larceny. But then you have embezzlement, which you're not allowed to vote. And so to me, those are injustices where you have the same act but different charges affecting a different group of people. If I could just limit it to that. Mm-hmm.
Caller, did she answer your question?
Yes, she did. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm going to put you back on if you have another question. Yeah, she was great. And so so now online I have a question. I guess this kind of triggered it. What types of white-collar sentencing versus blue-collar sentences are there other than the marijuana versus cocaine?
What I just mentioned, shoplifting versus embezzlement. Shoplifting versus embezzlement. Like, seriously. Those are the ones that I can think of. You know, you'll see your I can't think of any off top other than what I just mentioned with your shoplifting and embezzlement.
Because those are huge. I mean, with the cocaine versus having marijuana and how the sentences are differently. Okay, so I have another question from the online listener. Why are recorded conversations not used as evidence in court? Yeah. Why are recorded conversations as evidence not used in court?
I'm missing something there, because they recorded statements can be used as evidence. So I need a little more.
Why can't their conversation be used? Why can't their recorded conversation be used as evidence in court? So let's just talk about that. So is it true that if you're going to record a conversation so that it can be used in court, what are the dynamics around it? Do you have to let that person know?
Not necessarily, but the issue that you have with a lot of recorded conversations is authentication. And you want to prove that the person is who you say they are. So if there aren't any identifying factors, and even if it is, then you have to make sure that they are identified and authenticated. So just I need more from the question, because
that's all they typed in.
Okay.
That's all they type in.
It's so broad, and I'm not sure exactly.
Okay, so maybe they're still listening and they can tell us. Okay, so criminal, and this is what we've talked about previously on when I was hosting Let's Talk Law, the difference between a criminal case and a civil case, so that our audience will understand the difference between those.
Okay. Well, your criminal case has constitutional, like you have your Fourth Amendment, you have your 14th Amendment, and you have a liberty interest at stake. And a liberty interest is one of the highest interests that the Constitution can acknowledge and bestow upon anyone. It's because that it's your right to person, meaning that if you commit a crime, then if you're found guilty, you can lose your right to have control over your body. Okay, your civil side, the civil dichotomy is a pecuniary interest, which means that it has a financial monetary interest, and it also has, you have your property interest. And so to me, the criminal side is held to a higher standard in my purview because you can lose control of your body. And I think if you lose control of your body, I don't think money matters. So I think that's a broad general distinction between criminal and civil. If you have a more specific question, I'm all ears.
Okay, then I do have a couple more questions, but I do have to pause and to just tell everybody, if you are wanting to become a sponsor or a guest on the Loretta McNary Live radio podcast, please email us at loretta@lorettamcnary.com, and one of our producers will contact you. If you want to sponsor or advertise on the show, then we will have one of our producers to call you. But the email address, again, if you would like to recommend a guest, be a guest, or become an advertiser or a sponsor of the Loretta McNary Live radio show podcast, please email us at Loretta, Loretta, at LorettaMcNary.com, and someone will respond to you within 48 hours. All right, so we got that out of the way. Okay, now can you tell us the difference between the sentencing when it comes to a state crime and a federal crime? Because I've heard that federal sentences, you have to do all of it. A state sentence can do, 15% of it, or you don't have to do it, whatever they say. You get something off. How does that really work in real life?
In real life, well, there have been several bills that have been – well, before I get into the bills, there is, of course, you just acknowledged that there's a state sentence, there is state sentencing, and then there is federal sentencing. In federal sentencing, you have sentencing guidelines, and those guidelines are promulgated and operated by statute, and they're codified so that the federal judges can look at guidelines and say, based on your criminal history, based on your current charge, based on your acceptance of if you accept a responsibility for the crime, we have these guidelines, and you get points. And so you have, if you are a habitual criminal, which means that you have 3 or 4 felonies, federal, whatever it may be, then you get maybe 5 points. And so I'm giving you very general. You may get 5 points.
Okay.
If you are a first-time offender, you may get 2 points. If you accepted responsibility, they may deduct some points from that. And from those point systems, the court can have a range of sentence where they can go from 0 years to maybe 10 years, from 0 to maybe 15. If there are mandatory minimums, which means that you must serve a mandatory time or sentence, then it may go from 5 to 10. But in federal court, you have those sentencing guidelines that help guide the judge's hand in ensuring that sentences are consistent and they are parallel, because what we want in the criminal justice system is a we want it to appear fair. We want it to be fair but consistent. And so those sentencing guidelines help to operate and keep judges within a consistent guideline so that you don't vary from person to person, that is consistent. Now, state sentencing is at the discretion of the judge, but it's also within statutory, like we have statutes that specifically say if you murder, it's from zero, if you know, 0 to 20, 0 to 30, 0 to 40 mm-hmm. years life. And so with that, because there are no point systems, because there aren't any guidelines, the judge has discretion as long as it's within the guidelines or within the minimum and maximum terms as the statute requires. And so with the new bills that have been handed down, so to get to your question, so that's just some pretextual background. But to get to your question specifically, is that Mississippi has undergone a lot of reform. There has not been a lot of federal reform. Now, there has, you know, the president of the United States has signed a bill, which is the First Step Act, that will operate as some reform to the federal sentencing system. But Mississippi has become more progressive in trying to overhaul mass incarceration, where in 2014 there was a bill, the 585 bill, and it allowed a lot of people who are incarcerated for nonviolent crimes to be released early, right? And so these bills that have been passed down have actually helped with the harsher sentencing. There are bills that are in the House that they are trying to ensure will help with, as I think another caller asked about, blue-collar, white-collar crime discrepancies. But the trial judge has a huge discretion in sentencing. And you can get with those bills, like I mentioned earlier, if you're sentenced to 5 years, to serve only 25% of that time if it's for a nonviolent offense. If you are a first-time offender, you can get out if you serve 25% of that time. And so I would propose that the state courts have broader discretion in their sentencing, and it helps if you're charged in state courts where you can do 25%, but I don't know. And so I'm not saying it doesn't, but I don't know if you have that option in federal court.
Okay.
I do not
you're
know.
You're so thorough. I can see why Quentin Thompson referred you, because when I interviewed him, I told him the same thing. You are so thorough. I can only imagine you in trial. I would not want to be on the other side. I would just not want to, because you guys come prepared. So we only have about 13 more minutes. So I have a couple more questions, and then I'll maybe go back to the online questions too. But this is an online question. What do you do if someone writes you a bad check? What legally can I do if someone writes me a bad check? Is that a crime? I know at a certain amount, I guess.
It is. So you have misdemeanor offenses of that, I think it's under $1,000. I don't have the statute in front of me, but they can Google it if they like to. But a misdemeanor offense is under $1,000. Felony amount is over $1,000. Don't quote me on that because I don't have the statute.
Right.
But usually if you've done everything that you can do and you know this person has written you a bad check and you do not believe you're going to get your money, I would propose going to the police department and file charges.
Okay, after you pursue other recourse. Okay, so this is another question that I asked, and I haven't asked the guy attorneys, and I've asked several of the women attorneys, but even as an attorney and being a woman and then being a woman of color, have you yourself experienced prejudices when you're in court?
Oh, gosh. I hate to talk about my bad experiences because I think because it doesn't. So I have to answer your question.
That's all you got to say, because I'm like that too. I really hate to go negative on anything, but I just wanted to know.
I know.
And, you know, because everybody experiences it at some point, especially if you're in a professional public position like a talk show host or an attorney, mm-hmm. or, you know, even a police officer. The ladies in the, you know, special women of color have probably experienced it. So all we can do is say yes, so that we can encourage people. Don't let that stop you, because it's just another obstacle and you can overcome it. Don't give it too much, you know, handle it at your own discretion, but you don't have to keep talking about it and airing, you know, dirty laundry or whatever like that. Well, I like your answer.
Right, cause
I really do like that answer.
It's not everybody. It's not. You know, you have some bad.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like every day.
Mm-hmm.
So, going back to criminal law, I'm trying to read through some of these questions. Some of them, the wording is not good on them. The wording, come on, give me some complete sentences. Give me some complete. Okay, so let me tell them. Can I tell them how they can reach you? Can we give out your information?
Sure.
Your phone number?
My office number is 662-662-912-6927.
Say it again.
Mm-hmm. It's 662-912-6927.
Okay. So good. So we all will try and give that number out again for you all that are listening. So, okay. So being an attorney and you went to law school, first you were teaching, and I just want to kind of go back to your personal story, because I love it. I love it, how even in your bio it was worded, you went back, you decided to go and follow your dream. So you're teaching first, so you're teaching 6th and 7th graders language arts, you're coaching basketball team, you're coaching volleyball. Oh, my goodness, where do you have time to go to law school and to do anything else? How did you find time to balance everything you were doing?
I think after interning with the Committee on Homeland Security in D.C., I'm a country girl. I was raised in the Delta. And so being on the Hill, it reminded me what I was supposed to do. And I think every phase of my life, when it's time for me to move forward, you know, God always puts something in my path that pushes me to the next phase of my life. And I think interning with the Committee on Homeland Security was what reminded me that I enjoyed what I did, but it was something that was missing. And that's what pushed me. Mm-hmm. And so while I was in D.C., I began taking a class for the LSAT. And that's, you know, of course, the test to get into law school. And so while I was teaching, that time that I was in D.C., I started taking a course, a Barbie course, to take the LSAT. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So then you did some international travel within all of that. Mm-hmm. You traveled to France, Spain, Mexico, England, and the Netherlands while studying Spanish and international law. So tell me about that.
Well, while I was in law school, there's a program. It's the Cambridge. It's the University of Mississippi partners with Cambridge, and that's in the UK. And I had that opportunity at that time. President Obama was in office, and healthcare was such a huge issue. So I took up healthcare classes there, and it just broke down all the different healthcare systems. And I studied abroad, studying Spanish. And that was an undergrad. So I went to Oaxaca, Mexico, and studied at the Instituto de Cultura Oaxaca, where I picked up, you know, Spanish there, and lived with a family who did not speak English at all. And unfortunately, when I came back to the States, I tried to, as I was practicing, you know, they say if you don't use it, you lose it. And so after a while, not having anyone to really practice with, I still can speak a little bit, but not as fluent as I could while I was in Oaxaca, Mexico. And so traveling to internationally is something that I love to do. While I'm out of the States, I don't think about the States at all. And so I really enjoy just studying abroad, especially at Cambridge. It was a totally different experience, and it pushed me to a different level for sure.
Okay, so let's go. I'm just impressed with your story. I'm super impressed with it. Mm-hmm. And so let's go back to a couple more questions as it relates to criminal law. But you also say you do personal injury, too. And so we'll have to come back and talk about that, because I'm just this criminal thing, I'm trying to understand it. I know I want my audience to understand it, too. So
okay,
is there like if a crime was committed, but no one was ever arrested, like, you know how sometimes you'll hear about there was a body. Is there some kind of statute of limitation on getting somebody for a crime?
No. There's not a statute of limitations on that. And so that's why, now, something that you can refer to TV on, getting someone for it, if no one was ever arrested. You know, you have cold cases. And when mm-hmm. there is evidence discovered, they can reopen those cases. The issue is that evidence erodes over time, witnesses die, you know, things like that. But I don't think there's ever, and based on what I know, I'm not aware of any statute of limitations on someone being arrested or charged for a crime.
Oh, wow. And which brings me to the Me Too movement, which is a prime example of that as well, with the Bill Cosby mm-hmm. case. Those were, mm-hmm. you know, years and years ago, nothing was said or done. And then all of a sudden it comes back up and he's, you know, indicted and he's in prison. So I guess there is mm-hmm. even with that kind of crime, there's no statute of limitation.
Yeah. If you look at the historical in Mississippi, I think with the what's the guy's name? It escaped me. It's getting late. I've been pouring out all these questions.
It was someone in Mississippi that did something, and there was no statute. Yeah.
It's escaping me. I just lost his name. But he's in prison now. Mega Evers.
The guy who was responsible for his death finally.
Right. In the Mega Evers case, you know, he got off, but then, you know, they brought charges back against him years later. And so it just shows, if there's newly discovered evidence, if the case is cold and something comes up, then of course you can reopen those cases. You can. Now, there's a difference if a person is indicted. You know, if they're indicted, that's different. But if no one has been indicted, then yeah, if you have newly discovered evidence or they just want to reopen it, they can do that.
Okay, so I know there was a word when you were saying indicted, you were telling us about then how that indictment process works. The other word I hear a lot mm-hmm. is arraigned. What does that mean when somebody has been arraigned? Is that the word, the proper word?
Because
either you get indicted or you get – is that the other word? If you don't get indictment, what's that word called?
No, if you're not indicted, if the grand jury does not return an indictment, then it's called a no true bill. So either you're indicted or they no true bill it. A true bill is an indictment. No true bill, you don't get an indictment. Mm-hmm. But arraignment is just going before the judge, plead guilty or not guilty.
Okay, you were talking about the post conviction release. Say somebody was innocent. They've done all this time. What happens when somebody is found innocent finally and they are released because mm-hmm. they were proven innocent? What happens to them? Is the state or federal government supposed to help them? I mean, do they just say, "Oh, I'm so sorry"? What happens with that? Other than "I'm sorry" and "we're gonna let you go"?
Right. There is a civil statute in Mississippi that allows a civil civil remedy for those who've been wrongfully imprisoned, which means money.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is that in Tennessee as well, or is that just a Mississippi thing?
I don't know. I'm not licensed in Tennessee. Mm-mm. I'll be licensed in September, but I'm not sure about Tennessee. I know that's in Mississippi, though.
I want to be on the show before. I had some calls when I was at this other station. They were asking for an attorney in Mississippi, and at the time, I didn't know anyone. So now, when I get that question again, guess who I'm referring everybody to? To you.
Well, awesome. Send them my way.
Definitely.
I almost said I will not turn them down, but some people I can't help,
yeah,
of course, but I thought I would not turn them away. But if I can help, I'll definitely try really hard to help.
Okay, so when you have your license in a particular state, then those people who have been accused of or committed a crime or felt some wrongdoing within that state, so you can't live in Memphis but be charged in Mississippi. Do you get a Tennessee attorney or do you get a Memphis attorney? I mean, a Mississippi attorney.
It just depends on if that attorney is barred in both states. Your question is, if you live in Tennessee but you're charged
mm-hmm.
in Mississippi?
Right. Uh-huh.
Was that your question?
That's my question.
So
uh-huh.
If a person lives in Tennessee but they're charged for a crime in Mississippi, then they will get an attorney who's licensed in Mississippi.
Okay, that's how that works. Because I was wondering about that. I was wondering, oh, my goodness, this Irish time is up. Oh, my goodness. Any closing remarks? I want to definitely give out your phone number again and how they can reach you. And I want to say thank you so much for spending this time with me. And sorry about that last-minute reminder that you got and you had to scramble and make it happen, but I appreciate it. So, Victoria Washington, give out your phone number one more time.
No problem. I will, but I want to say one thing before I go is that I host an expungement clinic on March 30th, which is a free expungement clinic. So if you have charges in Mississippi and you're trying to get rid of those charges, then what you want to do is contact me or check my page. I'll have a free clinic where we will draft petitions and orders where you can send those documents to the court and try to clear your record. And that's on March 29th and March 30th. You can Google that, and it's free for the public. My number is 662-912-6927, and it's been a pleasure.
All right, everybody. Well, you have that information. If you can't find her, you know how to find me on all social media. Thank you all so much for listening. In closing, think positive, dream big dreams, help someone along the way, and we'll see you very soon on the radio. Bye-bye, everybody.
Awesome. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.